I'm so excited that we have Innovate Digital Solutions as a sponsor of HeCast this season. Innovate Digital Solutions provides anything that an office might need, hardware, software, IT, copy machines, things like that. They make an office run more smooth, and they're really good at it. But one of the things that I love about Innovate, their founders, Andre and Katia Brasso, they're people that don't just believe it's important to build a strong business, but also to take that success and build the strong community around them. They really have a heart for what HeChanged is doing. People they love have gone through some of the stuff that we talk about on this show. Andre and Katia both believe that you can build a life worth living, and there are these evidence-based solutions that can help build that life. We're so excited to be in partnership with Innovate Digital Solutions, and HeChanged It is better for it, and we hope you will be too. Go to innovate.ca and check them out.
Welcome to HeCast, the official podcast of HeChanged It. As always, I am Mike Chisholm. As always, I am excited. Am I excited for today's episode? Man, it's a hard subject, but yes, I am excited because we do not fear hard subjects here on HeCast, the official podcast of HeChanged It. Hey, speaking of HeChanged It, if you haven't downloaded the app yet, what the heck are you waiting for? Go to HeChangeIt.com. You can look at the mission of the company and what it is that we're doing. You can download the app. You can, for whatever technological device you have, and be part of the solution of men's mental wellness. My wife and her team, I'm just a podcast host here, but I just love supporting what they're doing by having these conversations. And today is a returning guest, Ben Gerner. If you watch his previous episode, he goes through a really, we do a really good job of telling his story. Counselor for over 30 years, mostly families and people focused on addictions and drugs. And when you look at what's happening out in, it seems that every city across North America right now is being affected by this. I mean, there isn't a person in a city that I don't know where they talk about how the homelessness is going up, drug use is going up, poisonings from drugs is going up. And, you know, punishment versus treatment, all of this stuff is in the forefront. It seems to be all the time of many of the conversations that we have. Ben and I go deep on this. He is a bare minimum an expert on the front lines of this from his perspective, his point of view. And since retiring, he retired and he moved to the island. That's a thing, you know, people, you know, they finish doing what they're doing. They go to Vancouver Island, a lot of folks to retire. He's become an advocate. He's always been an advocate. I should be very clear about that. He has. But boy, is he spending a lot of very well-used time to try and get rid of the disinformation that's out there. And really, at the end of the day, though, be a listener. He's a listener. It's not a matter of tribing up. And I just really appreciate where Ben's coming from. We have a really great conversation about the nuances of drugs, where they are in our society, how do we deal with it, treatment versus safe consumption, and the arguments on both sides. We talk about that. Really great dialogue that we have here today, and I'm certainly, it's a complex issue that's really, in my opinion, one that we shouldn't have hard, fast rules with because it is so nuanced. Ben does a really good job talking about that and has some really beautiful, tragic but beautiful things to say. It's a really good conversation. So without further ado, HeCast, the official podcast of HeChanged It, presents our episode with Ben Gerner. Ben, it is good to see you. It's been a while since we've seen each other. Yep. You've done a relocation and whatnot. So life gets busy. It is really, really good to see you again, man. Thank you so much for coming back on HeCast.
It's good to see you too, Mike. I there's quite a few things I miss about Kelowna, and you and the people there are part of that, right?
Oh, we thank you. Feeling is more than reciprocal. And so for those who are meeting Ben for the first time, you can go back if you want to go back and see his first episode of HeCast where he came on. We had a fantastic conversation in about the, around the world of addiction and substances and misnomers. I got to know Ben through an organization called Moms Stop the Harm. That's how I got to know Ben originally. And you know, the idea of, you know, we talking about this epidemic that is going on in our land, North America, when it comes to substances and whatnot. And, you know, the differences between some of the terminologies, a lot of the education that's out there is false education, but there's also there's a lot of polarization in when it comes to the world of drugs and addiction. Mm-hmm. And you know, the old guard seems to be, you know, punishment versus the new guard that's coming in, treatment. And obviously, when you have two sides that are so opposite of what they do, you know, there's going to be growing pains, and we are in the midst of it right now. Never mind the fact that fentanyl is everywhere, and it's not even a matter of people that are overdosing, they're being poisoned. There's poison that's out there that people are taking. Ben, you are deep in this world, and I just really, really grateful that you've taken time to come back on here and talk about some of this stuff with us.
Well, and I appreciate you having me on here. I think there's a lot of things going on right now that make it really urgent to talk about this and clarify a lot of this misinformation that's going around, and, you know, try and, you know, get the real stories out there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and now to give people context, because this podcast does go all around the world, you know, and we've talked about how, you know, He Changed It is based in Canada, and it's interesting watching the different countries around the world deal with this epidemic that is a global epidemic. It's everywhere.
Of course, yeah.
And it's interesting watching the different countries around the world and how they deal with it. Specifically in Canada, again, we talk about these two sides that are kind of pulling at each other, that sort of a thing. Let's talk some current events when it comes to this, Ben, and let's talk about what's going on out there as you see it, being someone that is like literally on the front lines of this stuff.
Well, I guess, first of all, I'll put some context to that. I'm not exactly in the front lines anymore. I've been retired, but that's helped me to really focus on the issues.
Well, the advocacy. You're an advocate. You are the front line of being an advocate on this stuff, right?
Fair enough, yeah.
but with a tremendous background. So maybe let's talk about the background first of what you retired from and what that's led you to on the advocacy side.
So, you know, for over 30 years, I was a clinician working with mental health and substance use. I did 15 years working with youth, doing specific, you know, parent-teen work and specific addiction work, day programming with them. I did the other half of my career basically working with both youth and adults, mm-hmm. Facilitating, creating treatment programs. I was a treatment provider. So using all sorts of different modalities of treatment, right? Not just one or two, but, you know, using a whole spectrum of different models. Mm-hmm. And and the last 10 years of my career, I spent pretty much my whole career in Kelowna, but the last 10 years pretty much on Leon Avenue at Outreach Urban Health at the time. I know it's different now since I've left, but, you know, I spent 10 years working with, you know, the marginalized folks that were down there. So there was so much more than just, you know, coming into an office and counseling. There was it just really opened my eyes to all of the other more global issues and more global needs that people were experiencing, more than just addiction and mental health, right? And housing and stuff. Yeah, it was all linked together.
All linked together. There we go. We just had a couple of episodes dedicated to physical health, and we have had a couple world-class trainers, physical trainers on, and it's just like the physical and the mental health, like they are linked. They are linked to each other like crazy. All of these things are linked.
Absolutely.
And when we start to create pathways to realize how the spider web that all comes back to our health, to our mental health. Yes, I'm glad you made that point there. They are all linked.
Yeah, they are all linked. And so that's sort of the background of you know, where I come from. And, you know, in those 30 some odd years, you know, what I did 30 years ago as a counselor was far different than what I was doing when I retired. And what I mean by that is we grew as a paradigm or an ideology, yep. You know, working in addictions grew and evolved. And, but I will say not all of it did. and we'll get a little bit more into that, but I'm thankful that the progress that we've made with addiction treatment and how we approach things, I'm really glad that we've made the progress that we've had. It's mm-hmm. not enough. We have to do so much more, but I'm glad that we've made some movement. And we can probably get more into that as we speak.
Yeah, and maybe we save that closer to the end where we see the movement because there's some optimism in that sentiment right there. And yeah. And it is important to focus on because so many times when there needs to be a monumental change that's made, so much is focused on the negative aspect of things or the part where people just are not seeing eye to eye and there's division and all of that stuff. And it is good to finish on some optimism. So kind of if we can remember, because I mean, mm-hmm. when you and I talk, whenever we talk, it's a fluid conversation that just goes. It's like jazz, right? It's almost like improvisation. But if we can remember to go back and come back to the movement that we have seen, the positive movement that we have seen, it's a game. This thing is a game of inches, isn't it? And we get kicked back sometimes 20 feet, and it's still a game of inches moving forward, right? Is that an accurate assessment?
And very relevant to what we're talking about, right?
Yep.
And what I mean by that is, you know, when we talk about things like treatment,
yep.
people look at treatment as one step.
Right.
You know, the only step, right? It is the cure. It is the silver bullet that's going to happen, that's going to solve all these problems. And I can tell you 30 years in this business, no, it isn't. You know,
right.
Exactly what you just said. It's inches. It's small steps. It's small steps, small steps.
Yeah.
Recovery is not a place. And we've known this for decades. Recovery is not a place. It's a journey. And it's an ongoing journey. And it changes for everybody. And it's very different for everybody. And that's a very important point because that is really what we're missing right now in searching for the answers to what's happening with with what we've started calling the opioid crisis, but now what I term as, you know, the toxic drug poisoning crisis, basically, because it's far more than just opioids and it's far more than just addiction. And we can get into that too. But back to what I was saying about treatment, it isn't one stop. It isn't one size. It has to be fluid. You know, like you said, it's got to be jazz, right?
Yeah.
It's got to be jazz, and it's because there's as many ways of approaching this as there are people that want to get help, mm-hmm. right? You know, what works for you may not work for me, and vice versa, and so the treatment industry is having problems recognizing that, as far as I can. I'll put that in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because there's
still... What are some of the problems that they're having recognizing?
Well, how I'll answer that is sort of answering your other question too. Okay. Right now, there's a movement that is trying to basically kill harm reduction in favor of abstinence only treatment. Mm-hmm. And that's just not going to work. Mm-hmm. And I've had conversations, I'll say, with various people, you know, in the industry, And I'll say in the beginning when I first heard that, I was mad and I was, that's bullshit. And I was all freaking out. But what I've come to realize is that, no, we have to work together. We have to work together. Harm reduction. I watched harm reduction every single day of my career. And I watched every single client that came through my office practice some form, some level of harm reduction.
What are some examples of harm reduction for the audience to that might not know about this? Sure. What are some examples of that?
Yeah. So, someone comes into my office and let's say they want to stop drinking. In fact, this is one of the cases that I had. The person was drinking a 2-6 a day after yep. work yep. and getting up refreshed the next day and going to work. This is like, whoa.
A functional alcoholic, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And so anyway, but you know, they knew it was a problem and they just didn't know what to do to go about quitting because they tried cold turkey so many different times. And of course we know that alcohol can be, well, the worst case scenario, alcohol can be a fatal withdrawal. Yep. And but it certainly is a very, very uncomfortable withdrawal between, you know, DTs and shakes and all the things that can happen. So we did an approach. And again, this doesn't work for everybody, but it worked for this fellow and a few others. But mm-hmm. but this fellow, we started reducing his intake mm-hmm. week by week, day by day. And we monitored it. And each he'd come in every 2 or 3 days, I think. It was a while ago. I can't remember the timelines. But,
yeah.
You know, he'd come in every 2 or 3 days. And he'd monitored right down what he'd been drinking and that kind of stuff. And within about 6 weeks, he was down to maybe 2 or 3 drinks a day. Mm-hmm. And after that, within a couple of weeks, he was sober and functioning and without any kind of withdrawal or anything like that. So harm reduction in that case was... for that fellow was mm-hmm. just reducing his use, just bringing it down, monitoring it, being mindful, all of those kinds of strategies that we use, right?
Yep.
Other forms, of course, are things like needle exchange for people who use needles.
You took the words out of my mouth. I think when you talk to some of these people that are out there that have these, snap judgment opinions, they would agree 100% with, well, that type of harm reduction for someone with alcohol, that sounds really, really good. But then you throw out something like needle exchange. Okay, now we're cooking with oil. Now's where you get people's emotions and opinions, ignorance into the equation. And this is one that, yeah. So let's talk about needle exchange here for a second.
And I'll just add to that. It's more than ignorance. It's fear, right?
Yes, thank you.
Fear of the unknown.
Yes. Right?
You see something that looks scary. And you're afraid of it, so you try and push it away.
Yes. And that way, when that happens, you close the ears and you don't even listen to the rationale. Again, I love spirited, even not even debate, but I just love when two sides can actually have their ears open and they can genuinely articulate where their mindset is coming from. And if both sides can listen to each other and recognize the fact and recognize that each one of them have a legitimate point of view and where it comes from, okay, we can usually find some sort of a compromise. There's usually some sort of resolution there. But you said the fear, and the fear automatically closes people's ears, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And we've been so used to I'll come back to the harm reduction in a second.
But yeah.
We've been so used to a certain way of looking at addiction that we've been, and I'll use the word indoctrinated over the last 80, 90 years from a certain program. And I'm not dissing that program, but I'm...
Cause and effect, are here.
Yeah. Yep. And it's a little dated, you know, and there's lots of great things about, I'll just say the 12-step program is a beautiful program, work miracles, but there's a lot of things about it that don't apply today.
Yep.
Especially to the opiate crisis. Okay.
Yep.
So,
okay. Yes.
Anyway, so a lot of the fear that we have is that, if we do this, we're enabling. If we do harm reduction, we're enabling. We're not looking after the addiction. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Harm reduction is not about addiction, and it's not about the drug. Harm reduction does not require abstinence, nor does it oppose abstinence. Abstinence is the greatest form of harm reduction.
Absolutely.
Right? But it's not required. And harm reduction strategies are meant to keep a person safe where they're at, right? And so, for instance, when we do needle exchange, we're keeping that person safe from things like HIV, hepatitis, other, you know, there's a whole hepatitis family that you could, I can't even remember all the hepatitis there are, but, you know, so there's all of those things that can happen. There's
is the plural hepatitis, hepatiti? I don't know. Anyway, keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, there's a whole, I'm sorry about that. No.
But needle exchange is to keep people safe.
Yeah.
Where they're at. I love that. That is a very succinct statement. Exactly. And I don't, it's hard to deny. It's hard to deny that sentiment, what you just said, because if somebody's in the throes, you want to help them out of the throes, but you want to keep them safe where they're at and as they move forward.
Exactly. You want to keep them safe where you're at. And my agenda is on the shelf with that.
Yep.
Harm reduction is that person's agenda, whatever they're willing to do in the moment. And when they're willing to, when I approach somebody as a counselor, I approach you and I say, so what would you like to do? And you say, well, I would like to do this. And I say, okay, let's do that then. Mm-hmm. You're going to be more willing to work with me.
Yes.
Right? You know, you're going to be on board with that. And I'm going to be respectful. And also what that provides for you or anybody is personal dignity. You know, you have your own dignity, your own self-respect when I approach you in that sense. And that's what harm reduction is all about.
So the opposite of that is, the opposite of that is being stigmatized and generalized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being thrown with a blanket.
Yeah.
And it's, if I'm hearing you right, it's way too complex a situation where you can put a blanket over top of this. It has to literally, like, again, a game of inches, it literally has to go down to each individual person and their individual journey.
Which
that right there shows the level of work that it's going to take to turn the ship around.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And that's going back to, again, there's no one size fits all. Right. You're right. You're absolutely right. You know, there's no one blanket. There's nothing like that. Yep. You made me think of that. There's a meme or whatever, a cartoon going around about, you know, there's a fella in the water who's sort of flailing in the water a bit, and another fella on a boat with a life raft. And the fella in the water says, you know, hey, throw me the life raft. And the guy in the boat says, how do I know you're not going to use this for drugs? You know? And that's the opposite of harm reduction. That's me throwing my agenda onto somebody else. Mm. Harm reduction is I'm going to give you that life raft without any expectation, because I know that you really want that life raft anyway, you know, to try and live, you know, try and get by. Maybe you won't quit drugs today. That's not up to me to decide for you, right? That's up to you to decide. So, and that's, again, what harm reduction is all about. It starts where the person is at. And this is where treatment is now in conflict, or I'll say current, some, I got to be careful, some current treatment is now in conflict with harm reduction and actually against it and refuses to look at it because it sees itself as that guy holding the lifesaver saying, how do I know what you're going to use this life raft for?
Yeah.
And to be honest and blunt, you know, you can attach the word enabling, that the concept of enabling to that, right? That person is working on the assumption that they're enabling you if they give you that life raft.
Yes.
Right?
The homeless guy on the street who approaches you for $5, and instead you go in the convenience store or the restaurant and you buy him a $5 cup of soup or a bagel or something like that, and say, here you go, because you know where that's going to go. Again, does not come from a place of ill intent. The intent is fine, but might be ignorance. And I'm not saying that person who does that is ignorant. What I'm saying is that sentiment exists, and that opinion becomes a blanket, or that sentiment becomes a blanket opinion for the entire subject we're talking about here.
Yeah. And the term for that has been thrown around a little bit, and that's been a savior, or sometimes white savior, depending on, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of a savior complex, and a lot of counseling and stuff traditionally has been savior, right? Mm-hmm. That I started that way. You know, I went in, I wanted to save everybody.
Yeah.
Right. So this is how I'm going to save you. But I learned over the years, no, I can't do that. That doesn't work. Mm-hmm. At least not for everybody. It kind of does for some. Some people really need that direction. But most people want their dignity, and they want to be able to make those choices themselves. And that's, again, my goal right now, you know, and hopefully if there's anything out of this talk that we can really highlight, is that the recovery community and the harm reduction community heals that rift that's happening right now. And begins to coexist together, so that, because they need each other.
Yes.
You know, I know we need more treatment. Of course we need more treatment, mm-hmm. but not at the cost of harm reduction programs, which is that's where it's going right now. We're already starting to lose a lot of harm reduction programs across the country, like safe consumption sites. Those kinds of things are starting to lose their funding and close down in favor of certain governments wanting recovery, abstinent-only type of recovery that's supposed to save humanity from the overdose crisis, right?
So what's the logic on the other side? What are they seeing with these facilities that exist? Is it the fact that they exist in general and people are just ignorant to the fact of it and they have that that opinion? Or is it a numbers thing? Can they back it up? Are there numbers on the harm reduction side showing progress? Or is the problem just so big and there is no, like, obviously they haven't thrown enough money at it and enough time and resources to fix the problem, no matter the modality of how they try and do it. Obviously, we're not putting near as much resources into finding a solution than is necessary. And I think that almost everyone can agree on that. But now we get into the spitballing of, well, the resources that we are putting in, what kind are we going to put in? So what does the other side say as justification for closing down some of these places?
Well, it looks like, to me anyway, mm-hmm. From my perspective and what I see that in the news and whatnot, people are seeing. So, for instance, outside a safe consumption site, there's probably a crowd of people, and that crowd of people are loitering, or whatever you want to call it, milling about and doing whatever. Maybe they're using, you know, on the side of the building or that kind of thing. So the community is saying, we don't want to see that.
Yeah.
And I get that, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, I don't want to see that our society has this problem. I'd rather not see that problem, if you know where I'm going with that, right? I'd rather that problem just disappear.
Yep.
So that's kind of where everybody seems to be going with that. We just want this problem to disappear. So we're going to close down the site. We're going to move these homeless people on or whatever.
Yep.
Thinking somehow that's going to make it go away.
Yeah.
But it's not going to go away.
No.
It's not. It's, you know, it's here to stay. It's been here forever. And it's going to be here forever. So so from that basis, people are saying, we don't want to see safe consumption sites anymore. From the basis of traditional treatment, traditional approach to addiction, mm-hmm. we're just enabling them to use drugs. Mm-hmm. There's very little concept of what, well, the only thing we're enabling with harm reduction is saving someone's life. We're helping them stay healthy. We're helping them to stay there so that someday, maybe, they're going to make a choice to move on and do something else. Right?
That's what it takes. You know, again, talking to these fitness coaches, I mean, we all know. All of us know that exercise is good for our bodies. Yeah. It's good for our minds. It's good for these things.
Yeah.
We all know the right answer.
We do.
But what is it that takes us to make that choice to start exercising?
Right.
It is the exact same scenario.
Yes.
In all of these other subjects that we talk about on HeCast, you know, I've talked about my dad with his anger problems. I don't talk about other people with anger problems because that's the one that I know that's in my life and he's okay with me talking about that. But I mean, you think about how many guys have you met in your life with an anger problem that has defeated it? It all comes down to a place where they are faced with a scenario where they can or do decide to make the choice and go from there.
Yeah.
Drugs is the exact same thing. Would you agree with that statement?
I would agree and just add a little bit to that. And just from my, you know, knowing what drugs do to your brain and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So, so we develop our habits and rituals and behaviors and all that kind of stuff. And that forms in our brains, and to make a very long story short. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens with drugs. Plus the extra little neurotransmitter things that happen with the drugs, the chemicals inside the drugs.
Sure. I would argue sugar does the same thing on a food level, but it's completely acceptable because, you know, it's sugar okay to see somebody drug. On the, you know, walking by with your kid. It's okay to see somebody chugging a big gulp.
Yeah.
But seeing somebody using drugs is it's a completely different social scenario.
I was just watching somebody the other day, a comedian, talking about something like that. And he says, and yet if you see a diabetic scarfing down a Snickers bar, nobody says anything.
Socially acceptable.
It's okay.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So we are living in a society, in a culture that has been indoctrinated to believe that drugs are bad, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's it. And so people who use drugs are bad. Mm-hmm. And so everything about drugs is bad. And it's so demonized. We should shun them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and yet for millennia, drugs have been a part of cultures for, like I said, for millennia and that kind of stuff. And that's a whole other conversation. I think you and I have actually had that conversation.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, we've had other people talk about, you know, the ayahuasca and all the, all of that stuff. Yeah. Yes, it is. It's the eye of the beholder and what people have been taught and told. Okay, so let me ask you this question. And I know we're off the beaten path a little bit, but you got a young kid in your life where you're an influence and you're teaching them about drugs.
Okay.
The realities of drugs, as you see it from your very unique, I don't think something can be very unique. I think it's just unique. Your unique perspective, you know, and educated.
Yeah.
How do you teach, what do you teach kids about drugs that's different than what society, what the school system perhaps, whatever. What do you teach them about drugs that's different from your point of view?
Well, my first knee-jerk answer to that is, I find out what they think they know first. Mm. So, you know, what have you heard about drugs? What do you know about it? You know, do you have any questions about it? And have them have, that's so important in speaking with kids or anybody is providing an environment where they feel comfortable and safe to be able to talk exactly about what they think about what they feel. So before you even get into drugs are bad, right?
Yeah.
Before you get into any of that, you make that environment safe. So you're curious about, so what do you, you know, when I talked to my daughter about it way back in the day when she was in school. So what are you seeing? That's all I asked. What are you seeing in your school? Oh, I see kids doing drugs. Yeah. What is that like for you? Blah, 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 you know, and then we get into this conversation. And then as the conversation evolves, I can, fortunately, I know a few more things than some people, and I can, I can input that.
Yeah, you're trained.
Yeah. I can input that into our conversations, right?
Yeah.
So, I know, you know, kids are, you know, using Molly right now, or they're using MDMA, right? have you ever heard that anybody's overdosed on that? I think, blah, 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 blah. Oh yeah, some people have overdosed, you know. And you get into those, and oh, well, this is because we've got this toxic supply out there that is being poisoned. And, you know, you need to be really careful if something like that. It's not don't do drugs. It's you got to be careful. You know, this stuff can happen. What do you do to stay safe? Right? So my kid or the kids that I talk to are going to tell me, well, you know, I'll probably maybe get my drugs tested if I go to a rave. Brilliant. Go do that. Get your stuff tested, right? If you're going to use. Mm-hmm. Best case scenarios, you're not going to use anything. Yeah. You're going to be the safest. But you know what? You might end up using it. If you do, here's what you can, here's the harm reduction kinds of things that you can do to make sure that you're going to be okay. Right?
Is it possible to get drugs tested in this world?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How do you do it?
Kelowna, when I left, there was three different locations. As far as I know, I don't know if there's still three. I know Living Positive Society there mm-hmm. still has a spot, but I've been out of the loop, so I don't know who else. UBCO, sorry, they've got I can't remember the name of the machine. Anyway, UVic here in Victoria has the same thing. So they do testing here. So there's a lot of, not enough, but there's a few places that will do it. Unfortunately, it's not very timely.
My entrepreneurial mind gets involved here. It's like, oh, is that a legitimate business where people can come in and get their drugs tested? I mean, with the amount of, and I mean, I don't mean to be glib in any way, but with the amount of poisonings that are happening, and I mean, this is happening to people. Like a good friend of mine, I've known him 25 years. His son passed away. We're just on a year right now. Now, I mean, we're talking like, and not just his son, but it's the scenarios. It's a scenario that is very relatable these days, unfortunately. You know, these three boys, they grew up together. They left school and moved into a house together. They lived together, like, and it just everything they did together, they won and lost by each other's successes and failures. They just were just three best friends, whatever. Yeah, they had got into some partying and stuff when they were young.
Who didn't?
Right. Okay. Now, but late 20s. Okay. So 27 mm-hmm. years old, one of them gets a new job, gets a really, really great opportunity. Wow. Let's go celebrate. Let's score a little Coke. Okay. Go score a little Coke and celebrate the night. Come back to the house and play video games all night or whatever. The one guy had work early in the morning. So he called it a night early. He came down to the basement and found his two friends dead. And I mean, you know, it's not like it's happening in situations like that.
Yes.
So often these poisonings that are happening.
Yeah.
And so I don't mean to be glib, but it seems like there's a legitimate business opportunity for somebody who wanted to buy one of these machines or whatever. Yeah. Come get your drugs tested.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like that is a mechanism that almost needs to be available in our society right
absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm dumbfounded at the fact that many of the folks in leadership don't take in the human story, and they do generalize so much.
What we do is we prioritize the addiction over saving lives. Does that make sense? Okay.
Yes, it does.
Because we don't want people to be addicted to drugs. Because at one time, that was a huge truth. You know, we don't want people to be addicted because we know it's a problem. It's unhealthy. You know, we know that.
Right.
So we must avoid addiction at all costs. Mm-hmm. But today, that cost has increased. And that cost is now, in many cases, death. Because to avoid addiction, we're not allowing ourselves to think outside the box and start doing things like universal drug testing. Mm-hmm. Can't do that. That's enabling. Right?
Yep.
Yep. So, and of course, the big topic of the day now is safer supply.
Yes.
You know, and a huge pushback against safer supply because... Yep. We can't enable addiction, right? even if Safer Supply saves lives, and I tell you it does, I've seen it, witnessed it with my clients, it saves lives. Even though it saves lives, people are willing to discount that and favor treating addiction over that. I don't know. I think that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. And if you, let's use the analogy. I mean, you know, you've got a group of people who they listen to the legislators and the lawmakers over everything. And we go back to prohibition in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay. So prohibition in the United States, the legislators and the lawmakers said, okay, alcohol is illegal, period. You know, the roaring 20s were roaring, but no more. Yeah. We're done. And so you get this black market, and this black market that is so severe that, I mean, you talk underground economy, you talk resources being used to fight this underground economy, this black market that's there. And then, you know, you get other people weighing in on things about alcohol and what it does for people and all of that. Now you get a group of people who, because the lawmakers say it's not right, okay, that's it. You know, that's the way it is. And that's a percentage. And I don't know how big the percent was. And then you get people who are trying to advocate and look at the cost versus the, you know, the ways versus the means, the cost versus the effect, all of that stuff. But the stigma, unfortunately, doesn't help the situation. And so I think we have a similar situation right now. It's like, okay, this stuff is out there. People, there's obviously a dramatic desire for it for whatever reason. And I mean, you know, in my opinion, the pharmaceutical industry can be blamed for a lot of the ramping up that's happened over the last, you know, couple of decades. And now legislators are there. And it's like when the legislators say something, when they make statements like that, some people, they just fall in line and they don't look at the other side of that story. So yes, what you said made absolute perfect sense. And this is the situation we're in. And it ain't an easy situation. That's a hard, hard set of truths to accept that that is our reality right now, but it is. And then you got guys like you who are in the middle that just literally want to help every single soul that comes into your view.
Yeah.
And now you're at a point where you can advocate and you can be at a macro level. And I want to go into some of the ways that we can find solutions for some of these things from your perspective, because I think it's really, really important. But also, let's talk about like current events, what's happening, and where the fight is, and how should people get involved, and what should they know?
Well, the fight is like I said earlier, there seems to be a fight between the recovery community and the harm reduction community.
Yes,
where there should be no fight.
Yes,
because. You know, urgent needs those two things to be together. You know, they need to be merged. They need to coexist, because harm reduction, recovery doesn't exist without harm reduction. Here's my scenario. Okay. Mm-hmm. Politicians, like you say, they're saying, this is the way to do it. We have to do recovery first. And this is what we're proposing. Elect us next year or this year or whatever. And this is what you're going to get. You're going to get more treatment programs. Mm-hmm. So here's my experience in the last 30 years with treatment programs. And I just wrote a blog on this on social media yesterday and today. Mm-hmm. And that is, okay, so here's how treatment works. As a counselor, somebody comes into my office. They need a referral from me to get into a treatment program, a residential treatment program. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in order for me to do that, my job policy-wise is to see them 3 or 4 times to assess if they're suitable for treatment. It makes sense, because not everybody is suitable for residential treatment.
Every situation is different,
right?
You got to get in there and see where things are at.
You get people coming in your office with concurrent disorders who are schizophrenic or schizoaffective or have narcissistic personality disorder, you know, all of these kinds of things. These things just don't fit into a residential group. Mm-hmm. And so really it made sense. I had to spend a couple of sessions with them to do an assessment to see, hey, is this person in? So there's a few days right there. Mm-hmm. They still haven't stopped using, of course. Mm-hmm. Right. So now we fill out the 25-page referral form to wherever that we're going to go to. It gets sent away. I hear within a week whether or not that person's going to be accepted. And then they have to wait up to a month or two before they get in. Mm-hmm. And then once that month or two comes up, they have to have 7 days abstinent before they go into the program.
Yes.
So, oops, right? Buddy goes to the front door and he just used the day before and they don't let him in. So now he has to start all over again, right? So now we've got another month of waiting and using and waiting and using. And then he gets into the treatment program finally. Someone else brings some drugs in. Happens all the time.
Yeah.
Right? He slips with that. Gets kicked out onto the street. Bang. First time. Zero tolerance of relapse in most treatment programs. Mm-hmm. So he's got to start all over again. And then, so now he's in. He's doing fine. He does the program. More than half of the people that finish residents or programs relapse within the first 6 months of coming out.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's treatment. That's treatment the way it exists now. That's the treatment that we're throwing all this money at right now.
Yep.
Okay. So, and again, that doesn't happen to everybody. You know, some people get through it, but most people in my career, I could probably count on one hand the people that made it through residential treatment once and stayed abstinent.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
In 30 years.
Yeah. I was going to say it's a long career. It's a lot of people.
Yeah. So yep.
That's some, a bold statement.
Some was twice, some was three times.
Yep.
At one point I heard the average was seven times and you know, it depends who you talk to, right?
Yeah.
So the point is, so if treatment is the answer, technically that none of those people should die, even if they relapse or they've gone to treatment, right?
Absolutely.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I lost 50 people in my last 5 years. Most of those people went to treatment.
Were a lot of those people in the in-between stage, the stage that you're talking about where it's like we're waiting for placement or they got kicked out the first time or whatever, or they had made some progress and then because that's another thing too, right? You know, tolerance. I've learned a lot about that. People have this high tolerance. They go cold turkey down to nothing, or they wean their way down to nothing, whatever. And then they go back to what they know. And the moment they go back to what they know, that's the ball game. It's over suddenly.
And add the toxicity to that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and then there's that part of it as well.
Yeah.
I'm so impressed with you. And I think I said this the last time I'm so impressed with you that you're able to keep sane. to keep the spirit that you have. Having seen what you've seen, Ben, what is it that keeps you going? Is it just this inert drive to educate and to want? Is it that savior complex that you talked about? What is it that keeps you going doing this, man?
Yeah, maybe. All I know is it drives my wife crazy. She keeps telling me I'm retired.
Yeah, no. Well, yeah.
And I'm
not.
You
can't shut it off, though.
You know what? It's very, I guess it's simple in one way. It's not like I was on a production line doing widgets.
Yeah.
I was working with people.
Yeah.
And I, you know, those 50 people that I lost, I take that personally because I knew all of their stories. Almost intimately, you know, I knew their stories. I knew their loves and their hates and their angers and their weaknesses and their strengths. You know, and they're all gone
mm-hmm.
because they went through that process that I just described.
Yeah.
And they had to rely on a poisoned supply. And so, but hang on. So to answer your question, what keeps me going is the fact that, you know what, I do have this experience. I don't know everything. you know, and there's certainly a lot of people that are much smarter than I am and, you know, even more experienced than I am for sure.
Sure.
But I have this, it's a gift. I've been given this gift, you know, mm-hmm. I've been through it. I've got lived experience. I know what it's like to be addicted. I'm an addict. I hate using that term. I'm a person that has been addicted.
Yeah.
But so that's part of it too. And I just know that there's an answer to this, but the people that need to listen aren't listening.
Yes.
And so I need to, you know, that's why, you know, we reached out to you guys again, you know, in every particular or every possible medium. I'm just saturating social media right now with awareness around this fight between the treatment and the harm reduction communities. We need to stop it, and we need to kiss and make up and realize that we need to work together. We need our safe consumption sites, because what's going to happen is somebody's going to walk out of treatment today and use.
Yep.
Now, if they go and use at a safe consumption site, their risk of dying almost disappears. Mm-hmm. Right. But if they go and use in a dark alley alone, their risk is astronomical that they will die. We need a safer supply, because those two people that you said, that you described, right? They weren't in need of treatment.
Nope.
They were not addicts.
Yes.
They were just people that wanted to party a little bit.
Yep.
And when you look at the BC coroner's report for 2023, you look at the coroner's report and you'll find that the majority of people, just a little over half of the people that are dying, are not falling into an addictive category.
Okay. So this is my other, this is where, Helen and all of the gals at Mom Stop the Harm absolutely blew my mind when they told me the stats of the people who are living everyday lives, normal people that are not in need of treatment.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that people in need of treatment are not normal, because there's so many of them that it is normal. It should be normalized, because that's how many there are, but we stigmatize it so that it makes it impossible to normalize. And that's a real shame. But that being said, through society's definition of normal, the amount of people that are being poisoned right now are astronomical. And that blew my mind when I learned about that.
Yeah.
Hopefully becomes a catalyst to actually do something to change the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, that might be what it takes. It might be, you know, some of these people that are in high positions that think they're removed from this, losing people. Because that's what's happened. People, I don't know somebody who doesn't know somebody where this has happened to them.
Yeah, I know.
There isn't one person that I know in my life that doesn't know somebody that this has happened to.
Yeah.
Like it's happening all the time. And we're not talking about it enough. And conversations like this are the things that'll get it out there.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that about where you're coming from. I appreciate the fact that you're a crusader, Ben. You really are.
Well, more from an armchair these days, but
but you can do a lot. You can do a lot from that armchair.
I do. I've met with our MLA and our MPs in Kelowna, and then now in Souk, and I'm calling them out. I'm not taking any bullshit answers anymore.
I was just going to ask: Are you annoying the hell out of them? Are you? They know who you are now.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. But but back to that, you know, it's why I appreciate you and the whole He Changed It movement is precisely that's the stat around who's dying.
Yeah.
Men.
Yep.
Between the ages of 18 or 19 and 59.
Yep.
Men. I wrote an article. I do blog. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's called domainoflife.ca.
Domainoflife.ca. Everybody check it and bookmark it now.
That's my blog. And I did an article called, and I did this with the Port Alberni CAT Community Action Team. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of great work. terms of getting information out there. And I wrote an article for them and put it in my blog, and it was on Blue Collar. And man, that was eye opening. I had to access US stats as well as Canada stats. Canada doesn't keep very good stats for some reason. You know, US keeps great stats. Anyway, you know, it was just mind blowing. You know, the male culture, the male work culture, sales, and sales and what else? Blue collar, anyway.
Yeah, manufacturing, things like that. Construction,
of that.
Yep,
are the primary targets, right? Those are the people that are doing exactly what those kids did. Let's go out for beers Saturday night, Friday night after work, right? Oh, there's a little cocoa. Okay, sure. Boom.
Yep.
Down we go. Right.
Yeah.
It was poisoned. It was tainted, and you know, and that's what's happening. People dying in their own homes, right?
Yes.
This isn't, not even half of the people that are dying are on the street.
Yeah.
Okay. When you look at the stats, they're like, it's not even like 30% or something like that.
Yeah.
It's more of people dying in their own homes, people dying at parties, those kinds of things. So, and yet here we go again. The political community is making it about homelessness and making it about crime and making it about, we mentioned this earlier. I've heard this term today. Politicians are rage farming.
Yeah.
They're creating a rage around all of this crime and stuff that's happening and saying it's all because of this overdose stuff and drugs and addiction.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a bit of a role there, but that's not what's causing it.
It's way more complex than that.
Way more complex. So my other thing about this and my big takeaway for everybody, the deaths caused by the toxic overdose crisis are not caused by addiction. Treatment works for addiction, but treatment is not going to work for a drug policy problem.
Separate issue.
Right? Separate issue. The drug policy problem is that drugs are prohibited. Certain drugs are illegal, which we've just talked about all of the things that happen there, like they did with alcohol. Mm-hmm. They're happening with drugs. There's a thing called the Iron Law of Prohibition. I don't know. The Iron Law of Prohibition. If you've heard of that or not.
It rings a bell. We might have talked about it the last episode, but please, yeah.
What it simply says is the more sanctions you place on something like a drug, the more toxic it's going to become.
Yep.
Because it has to be easier to distribute. It has to be undetectable. Mm-hmm. And you look at fentanyl. Fentanyl was almost undetectable. You know, it was easy to distribute. It was. And it created a huge profit margin.
Yep.
Right. So that's what happened. That's what happens with prohibition is you get this. This balloon effect almost where you squeeze it, you try and do this, but it just gets bigger. Right. I don't know if that makes sense.
The idea, the idea of prohibition. I mean, you know, the opposite would be, decriminalization or legalization, whatever you want to call it,
big difference between the two, but
well, there is a big difference, but whichever. And I mean, we've seen places that have done both, you know, around the world. We've seen places that have looked at it both ways. The idea of either of those two things, I think the fear, and it's probably a justified fear, is that it's going to get worse before it gets better. Because some of those people that listen to the letter of the law, some of those same people, if you change the law, like I'm so curious to know the number. Since we have decriminalized marijuana in Canada, I am so curious to know the number of people that have become marijuana users. And no judgment either way, like none whatsoever, like zero. But I'm just super curious about how many people stayed away from it simply because it was a prohibited product. You didn't have dispensaries on every, you know, every second corner where it was available, like liquor stores. I'm super, super curious about that. And certainly if we talk about some of these more, illicit drugs, the idea of decriminalizing, what would be the short term, hit on society? Or would that be completely negated because supply would now be safe?
Well, what I advocate for, and I've always advocated for this, is decriminalization, complete proper decriminalization. What we have in BC now is not working. It was set up to fail because simply by the cap that they put on the amount, it was unrealistic.
Right.
Okay. That's another long story, but
but
it was set up to fail. And so now we can all look at that and we'll see it doesn't work.
Right.
Because we didn't do it right.
It needs to be tweaked before we make that decision.
Well, we needed to do a lot of things to put in place. But the main thing that I would like to see in this is decriminalization to the point where we can have an infrastructure where safe supply can exist.
Yeah.
And can be distributed. So the current, here's another current issue.
Which, by the way, is good for the economy. If you did that, by the way, it's good for the economy to do that.
Yeah.
Less resources are going to fight it.
And
resources are now available to build it, including entrepreneurship and all of that stuff, even though it's a subject that many people are a little bit uncomfortable with. Well, so are other things that are illegal or that are legal, I should say, that are also big business.
Yeah. So that brings up the fairly current issue of the Drug Users Liberation Front. Mm-hmm. Otherwise known as DULF. Okay. There's two people that were arrested. Two people were arrested. Have you read the study that they put out at all?
No.
Okay. So I should send you that. So
yeah, please do.
They were funded by UBC, I believe. Or Fraser. Don't quote me on that. One of the two universities.
They're funded by a big university.
Yeah, funded by a big university to do a study. So what they did is they created a compassion club, okay, for illicit drugs, for cocaine, crystal meth, and heroin, mm-hmm. right? And they created this facility, this infrastructure, where they could test the drugs, make sure they were pure, and then sell them at cost to what it ended up being, I think, around 47 people that were on the program, on the study, right?
Yeah.
So they started with that, and they did this for a year. And the study ended up showing more than half of decrease. Some of my words are all mixed up. Sorry.
No, we're good.
Hospitalizations, Sarah. Sorry, I need to get my hospitalizations went down by more than half.
Yeah, see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Overdoses went down by more than half.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Contact with police went down way over more than half.
Mm-hmm.
So less crime.
Yeah.
And zero deaths.
See.
From that over that year. And that study is now published in Science Direct, it's called. I can send it to you if you like.
Yeah, please do.
So what happened? Vancouver police went in and arrested the two people.
Yep.
Yeah. So they arrested the two people claiming that they used their funding to buy the drugs. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
what
happened prior to the study being finished is that the funding was pulled before the study mm-hmm. was finished. And so the two people had to go to the dark web.
And, oh, for crying out loud.
And buy the substances there so that they could, you know, cleanse them or whatever they do, test them and use them and do this study. And the study came out exactly the way we expected it to.
Yeah.
It works. And at the current moment, there's been no charges laid. These two folks were arrested. They're awaiting a court date. They've done a counter thing with human rights now.
Yeah.
So there's a counter suing or whatever. I'm not a legal guy. So
Yeah. But they're standing up for themselves.
Yeah. So that's going to be a really interesting process to see what happens. But these two guys are heroes, right? I mean, they broke the law, but they saved 47 lives. You know, they could save 47,000 lives if people would just listen.
Yeah. You know? And you're not being hyperbolous with that number.
No, I'm not.
Tens of thousands.
Over 30,000 now in Canada.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
21 people a day are dying. Six to seven people in BC right now are dying. Six or seven people died today as we were speaking. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's real. It's happening. And there's things we can do about it, but we're refusing to do them.
That's why from your armchair, you're doing what you're doing. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. We're going to finish, by bookending, talking about, you know, some of the movement forward that you have seen,
some of the,
where is the optimism? And again, in a game of inches, sometimes it is, fractional, but we need to find it. We need to, so what is some of that, So that optimism there.
My optimism is what I've seen happen with harm reduction, with things like supervised consumption sites. When it first opened up in Kelowna in 2017, it was right behind our clinic. It was a mobile unit. And it got to the point where they were doing 100 people a day. Mm-hmm. So 100 unique contacts a day, no deaths. A couple of overdoses, but they were... Right. They were, that's what they were there to try and stop. You know, people brought in what they were going to use. If they overdosed, there was a nurse there to stop the overdose basically.
Yep. Yep.
And of course they're right behind the clinic. So people would connect with me sometimes. They would connect with social work. They would connect with harm reduction services. They would connect with doctors and other nurses in the clinic. So there was this infrastructure that all of a sudden was created from this disaster, from this tragedy of that. So that was huge progress, and I was glad to see that. And then as I retired and kept in touch with everybody, that evolved into a stationary site. And so there was one huge place where, you know, what Outreach Urban Health was this one big place now. That's providing, you know, all of these harm reduction services. People can walk in and be supervised and look at any kind of medical help they need, any counseling that they need. Lots of counselors there, social work, that kind of thing. I've seen a change in how we look at treatment. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more acceptance. There needs to be a lot more yet, but there's a lot more acceptance of things like methadone and Suboxone, right? Mm-hmm. There was a time when, Suboxone was huge. In 2017, it became the preferred approach to opioid addiction, right? And made available. So the pharmaceutical industry made all of that available. So it's evolved out of that. I saw supervised injection. What did they call it? They called it IO, so injectable opiate agonist.
Yeah.
So people that were used to using injectable heroin, and I had quite a few clients on the street that were doing that, all of a sudden could see the doctor in the morning and the evening and inject their drug, get it prescribed to them, and they would inject in their office and then go about their day. Mm-hmm. And I watched the miracles and the two guys specifically. One guy came out of this dark, dark place that he was in because he was always doing crime and he was depressed and he never thought he'd ever get out of this. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden he had this intravenous, you know, prescribed program. And he didn't have to worry about doing any more crime. And he joined up with this employment program. And he joined up with this this group. And he got a job. And he's still using. Mm-hmm. But he's using in a controlled manner. Harm reduction, using in a controlled manner. Mm-hmm. And his life did a 180. It was beautiful. His face just lit up. It was fantastic to see. Mm-hmm. Another guy, same program. Ended up... eventually going back onto methadone and then eventually weaned off methadone and became abstinent. Mm-hmm. Right. Another three or four people that I know of were on that program and just stabilized, you know, they got housing. They were able to get off the street. You know, there's so many successful things that happened when we evolved from just say no, to, yeah, you know what, let's do what you need to do here.
Yeah.
You know, and so those are all good examples of the evolution I've seen that's happened so far.
Ben, I go ahead. Please, no, finish. No, please, please.
I'm good.
Well, okay. So we need to do this more. And now that season two, like we're already sort of wrapping the recordings for season two here. I want to have you back on season three, and I want to continue. There's such a you are one of my favorite people to talk to about this.
Oh, dude.
I love it so well, and I mean we connect so much. Yeah. By the way, before we finish, are you playing music out there?
I am playing music.
Good boy. You know, because one of the things that we talk about on HeCast all the time is that guys, we many times don't feed the thing that's inside of us that's there that just is stretching to get out. I know you and I, music is both a commonality for both of us. Yep. And I know that you are more you and you're a more effective you when you're playing music in some capacity. Yeah, so that makes me very, very happy to hear. Yeah. If people want to find you, where are the best places to find you, Ben?
Well, right now I'm like I said, I'm saturating social media. So Facebook, yeah, Instagram, TikTok.
And just your name?
And Threads. Yeah. The new Thread thing on
Instagram. Yeah, Threads. Yeah, you're doing Threads too.
Yeah.
So oh, Ben,
I guess I'm doing X as well too.
Oh, there you yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. We're all doing X now. Excellent. Yeah. We're all in the same category because there's no more Twitter. We're all on X, everybody. Ben, G-O-E-M-E-R, right?
Nope. G-O-E-R-N-E-R.
G-O-E-R-N-E-R. Okay, so Ben Gerner, G-O-E-R-N-E-R. Yeah. Thank you very much for that.
My blog, domainoflife.ca.
Yep. Yep.
And I scored on that name, man. I love it.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I'm grateful that you exist in this world, my friend. I we need to talk sooner than later again about this stuff. And thank you for fighting the good fight. Obviously, what needs to happen is, the solution to bad speech is not, in my opinion, is not censorship. It's better speech. And more talking and more dialogue. Yeah. And that is certainly what you are doing. You and all of the organizations out there. We've talked about Mom Stop the Harm. Let's talk about them again just for 1 second. I mean, they're so amazing. Check out Mom Stop the Harm. Search for them as well. And let's all start listening to each other and talking a little bit more rather than shouting and tribing up and all of that. And I just want to just thank you so much for sharing your perspective on this, Ben. I really appreciate it. I'm gonna do a quick outro. Just hang tight. I'm just going to do a quick outro and we'll say goodbye privately. Okay.
Great.
I love hosting this show because I get to hear from people with extremely educated, informed opinions about where we're at as a society and so many things. And as much as He Changed It talks about all of this proactivity and how we can live better lives, sometimes we got to get into some of the harder stuff. And I really appreciate there are guys like Ben out there who can help talk about this stuff and has literally taken one for the team because he's a guy that has listened to these stories and taken on these stories, and every story is unique and individual. And, you know, it's not a one size fits all issue, not even close. It is so minute. It is like everybody has their own individual size. And how do we tackle that? Well, the first thing that we do is we talk about it, we acknowledge it, we listen to each other. And if you've got somebody who, you know, this is the situation that they're in, let's do something to try and help them and figure that out. This has been another episode of HeCast, the official podcast of He Changed It. My name is Mike Chisholm. Go change something.